This is Writer's Voice. We talk to writers of all genres about matters that move us and make us think. Welcome to the show. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.
One of the things that's been a kind of guiding light of my own journalism and then my fiction is the real core belief that what unites us as human beings is always greater than what divides us.
That's Geraldine Brooks, author of People of the Book. It's a fictional account of the history and rescue of the Sarajevo Haggadah. She's our first guest today on Writer's Voice.
Text, which is what most people think of as poetry, print on paper, to me is musical score. It's notation that has to be sounded or brought to life in some way.
And that's California Poet Laureate Al Young. We'll be talking to Al Young in the second half of the show. My guest, Geraldine Brooks, was a war correspondent for the Wall Street Journal in Sarajevo during the siege of that city by Serbian paramilitaries in the early 1990s. While there, she learned about the remarkable story of the Sarajevo Haggadah, a 14th-century illustrated manuscript used for Passover by the family who commissioned its creation. But when the Jews were expelled from Spain by the Inquisition in 1492, the book went with them and ended up finally in Sarajevo, where it would have fallen into the clutches of the Nazis were it not for a brave rescue by the head librarian of the Sarajevo National Archives, a Muslim. And again, when threatened anew by the Serbian siege of Sarajevo, it was rescued by another Muslim librarian. Gwendolyn Brooks has written a terrific novel about the history, rescue, and restoration of the Haggadah titled People of the Book. Among other works, Brooks is the author of two other novels, March, for which she won the Pulitzer Prize in 2006, and Year of Wonders. Geraldine Brooks, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Well, it's lovely to be with you.
Now, your book, your novel, People of the Book, it's a fictionalized account of the history of one particular existing book, the Sarajevo Haggadah.
That's right. That's a very rare Hebrew manuscript that was created in Spain sometime in the mid-14th century. And it still exists today because of a number of remarkable rescues, some of which we know about and some of which we can only imagine.
And you do imagine them in your book. Along the way, it really tells a whole lot about the history of the Jews in Europe, not just the history of this one book.
Well, absolutely, because the book was created at a time, one of those rare, quiet, and peaceful eras for the Jews of Europe in Spain during Convivencia, when Muslims, Christians, and Jews managed to live together, if not in a perfect love fest at all times, at least in a spirit of cooperation and coexistence. And that went on for a couple of centuries before the forces of hatred and fear of otherness manifested in the Inquisition and the expulsion of Jews and Muslims from Spain.
The hatred and fear of otherness?
Yeah, I think this little book has borne witness to this same phenomenon over and over again, where you have a society that is peaceful and prosperous and where people learn from each other. And certainly that was true of Spain in Convivencia when Latin was being translated into Arabic and Hebrew into to the sort of proto-Spanish language of the time. And everybody was learning from each other's discoveries about physiology and astronomy and enjoying each other's poetry, and then that all gets smashed apart by this kind of idea of monoculture where we all have to be one thing, and in that case it was all had to be Roman Catholic or else. And then the book leaves Spain probably at that time, we don't know for sure, and it winds up in Venice when the Pope's Inquisition is on a book-burning frenzy, trying to root out anything that could be construed as heresy or against the Catholic Church, and it survives then because a Catholic priest proclaims that it has nothing of a heretical nature in it. And somehow then it makes its way to the Balkans.
And the Balkans, the book starts out in a much more contemporary time of the Balkans, well, not exactly contemporary, but recent history. That's in the 1990s during the
Siege of Sarajevo, exactly, where once again you had the mentality that supported ethnic cleansing, that wanted only one kind of person, you know, and it was that ideology had its face set against the multi-ethnic ideal of Sarajevo, which is a city where diversity has been celebrated for centuries.
Yes, and now say something about Bosnia and Sarajevo in particular, in terms of this the convivencia that was extant there until the ethnic cleansing of the war.
Well, the first Jews came to Sarajevo, which was a sort of a small crossroads trading town in the mountains, about 100 years after the expulsion from Spain, and they came there because the Ottoman Sultan, who was ruling those lands at the time, actually welcomed Jews who were seeking refuge from the persecutions of Catholic Europe of the day. And so there was a small Jewish community where people could live in mostly unharassed, unnoticed lives. And then there's a, you know, Croatian Catholic community there. There's a Serbian Orthodox community. And, of course, the majority Muslim community. And everybody lived in, shared the same neighborhoods, and the mosques and the synagogues and the churches are all in the same block. And it was just a very tolerant, accepting place where difference was seen as a good thing, not necessarily a defining thing.
Well, you've given us kind of an overview of the book, of the vicissitudes that it went through. We'll go more deeply into that. But I wanted to say first that I went online and to find out more about the actual book, and I found a German website to which we have a link on our website, writersvoice.net, which allows a visitor to page through the marvelous images of the Sarajevo Haggadah. Describe to us what these images are like.
Well, the remarkable thing about these images is that they exist, because in the medieval period, most Jewish books were not illustrated in any way because of the commandment that thou shalt not make any graven image or likeness of anything. And so it was thought that that commandment had suppressed figurative art among medieval Jews. And yet the Sarajevo Haggadah is full of beautiful pictures, and what they are is illustrations of biblical stories. And yet they're very recognizably set in medieval Spain. So when Moses is asking Pharaoh to let his people go, Pharaoh looks for all the world like a Spanish prince with a golden crown. And when the plague of frogs visits Pharaoh, the frogs are all coming out of a Spanish warming oven.
A Spanish warming oven.
Yes.
That's marvelous. And how did you know what it was?
Oh, just I'd seen these in Spanish homes when I'd been, you know, touring some of the historical sites.
Oh, that's great. Now, there's a very special image around which you spin a marvelous tale, in fact, a very crucial part of the book, and that is an image of a black African woman sitting at a seder and holding a piece of matzah. Tell us about this image, and what do you make of it in reality?
This is one of my favorite illuminations in the book. And as you know, the Haggadah is the book that you use at the family dinner table, at the Seder or Passover meal, where the story of the liberation of the Jews from slavery in Egypt is retold. And so this is a Spanish domestic scene. It's obviously a very affluent family. You can tell that from the clothes that they are wearing, beautiful ornate robes and so forth. And yet at the table with this prosperous Spanish Jewish family is an African woman. And nobody knows who she is. And there's been various speculation by scholars that perhaps she was a family servant and so forth. And yet she's dressed just like the family members. And her robe is saffron colored, which was a very expensive dye of the day. So it could be that, you know, she was a friend of the family, but if she's African in Spain of the medieval period, she's Moorish, and that probably means she was Muslim. So it's very interesting to think about who she may or may not have been, and it's one of the mysteries of the book that I've allowed myself to solve fictionally.
Yes, you do a wonderful job, actually, of solving mystery by mystery. Now, I'd like to go through a few of them and also tell us if some of these artifacts were really or objects were really found in the book. But first, let's go back to the story itself. You have an Australian, a conservator is what you would call her, right?
That's right. Well, I had to deal as a novelist with how I was going to tell a story that spanned 5 or 6 centuries and half a dozen different cultures. And I had to think about what was going to be the connective tissue. And I had a very lucky stroke while I was still puzzling this issue of finding out that the United Nations actually was funding conservation work on the real Sarajevo Haggadah. And they allowed me to go and be a witness in the room while this work was going on, which was a rare opportunity to actually spend time with the book itself. But I learned a lot about what conservators do, and in watching that work, I got the idea of how to structure the novel and that my protagonist would be a book conservator who's called in to work on the manuscript. And I learned that a lot of the business of book conservation has to do with being a detective, really. There's a lot of detective work and sleuthing involved in finding out what the various little bits of artifacts that you might find trapped in the binding are, whether it's a quill pairing or a breadcrumb or something like that. Chemical analysis can often add to the knowledge of the book and where it was and whose hands it might have been in at various times.
Tell us what it was like to actually here have the subject of your book and to be able to be in the same room as those who were working on it.
Well, it was marvelous. It was a fantastic opportunity. It was a very unusual setting for book conservation work because it was just at the end of the war and things were still rather unstable in Sarajevo. And so there were tremendous numbers of guards. There were Bosnian police and there were museum officials and there were peacekeeping troops from the UN. And so the room was rather crowded. And it was in a secure room in the National Bank of Bosnia. And at the center of it was this woman whose name was Andrea Pataki. And her job was to assess the manuscript and to stabilize the binding so that it could safely be put on exhibition.
And there was another person in the room, too, who was critical to the very existence of the book right there at that time.
Well, that's fictional.
Oh, really?
Yeah, no, that is where the fact ends and the fiction comes into it. But there was actually, I was inspired by the story of what had happened to the manuscript during the Bosnian War, because when I first heard about it, the book was missing. And there were all kinds of rumors about what might have happened to it. But it turned out that a Bosnian librarian, a Muslim, had risked his life to save this Jewish book at the beginning of the war by going into the museum when it was being shelled and figuring out how to crack the safe where the book was and bringing it to safety, hiding it until it was safe to return it to the museum. So I used that story in my fiction as an inspiration for one of the characters.
So he wasn't there in the room while it was being worked on?
He was not.
But it is quite a story in itself, and it wasn't the first time that a Muslim librarian had rescued this book.
Indeed. During World War II, a Nazi general had come looking for it for a particular pet project of the Führer's, which was to be called the Museum of the Extinct Race. And the idea was that after all the Jews of Europe had been exterminated, there would be a kind of a little Jewish toy town Disneyland tourist attraction. And it was planned to be in Prague, and a few Jewish buildings had been spared from the general destruction in Prague to house this museum. And Czech actors were going to be paid to dress up as Hasidic figures and walk around for the amusement of Aryan tourists. And the museum was being stocked by some of the most beautiful works of Judaica that had been looted from the great collections of Europe, and the Haggadah was very sought after to be an exhibit. And when the general came to the museum, the chief librarian refused to hand it over. He hid it, actually, in the waistband of his trousers and pulled his coat over it and went and told the general that another German officer had already come and demanded the Haggadah, and of course it had been relinquished into his hands.
A real brilliant intervention.
It was quite brilliant. The general, of course, was furious and said, who was that? Name the man. And the librarian Dervish Korkut was his name, said, oh, sir, we didn't think it was our place to demand a name.
It's just
and then he walked out of the museum with the book under the noses of the Nazis and took it and hid it in a mosque for the duration of the war.
And we're speaking with Geraldine Brooks. She's the author, most recently, of People of the Book. It's a fictionalized account of the history and rescue of the Sarajevo Haggadah. Now, he not only, this man, Dervish Korkut, and in the book he's called Serif Kamal, he did not only rescue a book.
That's right. The real Korkut family also sheltered a young Jewish woman and kept her safe, hid her in their own home until they could find a way to get her to a safer part of the country.
She figures also in your book, but, you know, I also read, you had a piece in The New Yorker.
Well, the real story of what happened there was too fantastic even for fiction, so I felt I had to write a factual nonfiction account of what happened during the time of the war and the aftermath of this rescue, which has another chapter that's played out in the lives of the librarian's child and the child of the Jewish woman that he rescued. And it's such a remarkable story, so I wrote that for The New Yorker magazine, and that account appeared in a December issue. But it's also available on my website if anybody is interested in it.
Oh, yes, give us that website.
It's geraldinebrooks.com.
Great, and we will link to that also on our website, writersvoice.net. Now, tell us a little bit more about this story, because that is a real story, because what I found so remarkable was that there's a whole kind of a redemption story that is within it. He saves this young woman. After the war, he is brought up on charges of being a Nazi sympathizer.
It was very common when Tito, who had led the partisan resistance to the Nazis, was trying to consolidate power. Anyone who was inconvenient or too outspoken, the easiest way to get rid of them was to stitch them up as a collaborator with the Nazis. And there was a death penalty attached to that accusation. And Dervish Korkut was no more of a pushover for, you know, communism than he had been for fascism. So he spoke out when he felt things were going in the wrong direction. And he was fingered as an enemy of Tito and brought up on these trumped-up charges. And his wife asked the young Jewish woman to testify for him and to say that he'd been a resistor, not a collaborator. And the young woman said she would, but then her fiancé wouldn't allow her to appear in court because he felt that in a politically motivated trial like this, she could be risking her own life to stand against the will of the party. And so she didn't. And that always haunted her as she went on and was an old woman herself. She always thought that this man who'd saved her had been killed by the Nazis, and it was a great guilt that she carried in silence for many years. Until quite by accident she found out that he was still alive and that although he had served jail time, he'd been released and rehabilitated. And at that point she went and testified belatedly, but to Yad Vashem, that he had saved her. And so he and his wife are recognized in the Garden of the Righteous at Yad Vashem.
Yad Vashem being the
Holocaust Memorial and Study Center in Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And the family had, each of his children had a copy of the certificate that Yad Vashem issued about their parents, and they're very proud of that. And when his daughter was living in Kosovo, when the ethnic cleansers started their work in her neighborhood of Kosovo, and she and her husband were driven from their home and separated from their children, they ended up in a desperate refugee camp on the border with nobody willing to take them. And they showed the certificate to a member of the Jewish community. And the Jews were very keen to repay a debt from World War II. And so they organized sanctuary for the family in Israel. And the children and the parents were reunited and flown to Israel, where they were met by the son of the woman that her father had rescued.
An incredible story. The woman who was herself rescued by their father now, after her death, I believe, isn't that correct?
Yes, that's right.
Was able to
rest. Her words were the cause of the daughter being rescued in her time of trouble. So it was a debt repaid.
Right. So now back to what I was saying before, you have a wonderful way of you have these clues that are found within the book. We don't really have time to go through all of them, but just to give our listeners a taste of how you pursue this story, Hannah, who is the name of the conservator, the Australian conservator in your novel, People of the Book, she finds an insect wing. Tell us about that.
Well, as I said, when I was watching The Real Conservator, anytime she found anything in the binding, she set it aside for further study. So I decided that Hannah would find a little piece of an insect, and then she would have to go and get scientific help to analyze what this insect was and whether it would tell her anything about where the manuscript had been. And, you know, we live in a world of insects and arthropods, so it could be that it's something perfectly common that wouldn't really add any knowledge, but in this case, it turned out to be part of a butterfly that only exists at elevations of the high Alps. And so that was my way of jumping the story backward in time to when the Haggadah was hidden in a mosque in the mountains outside Sarajevo.
So a wonderful way of interweaving fiction to tell the real story, because it was, in fact, sheltered during World War II
in the mountains. That's right. So I decided to use these little artifacts as my mechanisms for time travel, if you like. So Hannah finds a clue in the binding. It might be a white hair or a scraping of salt crystals. And as she does her scientific analysis, the reader is allowed to see how that thing actually got into the book in the first place. So the reader ends up knowing more of the truth than Hannah manages to detect, although she does make some astonishing discoveries and solve one of the big mysteries of the book.
Right. And you must have felt that in that case you really wish that reality was imitating art, because I'll bet a whole lot of people would like to know who, in fact, wrote this book.
I think that now that things are more stable in Sarajevo and peaceful, that there'll be more research done on this codex, because it really hasn't been thoroughly studied up until this point. And it's something that I'm sure many, many scholars would be interested in pursuing.
Now, there's another place in which you base a character on a real character in this book, People of the Book. You go back to Venice, and I read that you based one character on a particular historical rabbi.
Indeed, there's a marvelous autobiography written by Leon de Medina, and he was a rabbi in the ghetto. He was famous for his wonderful sermons, so Catholic priests and friars used to cross the bridge into the ghetto to hear him preach. But he also had a gambling problem, which he speaks about indirectly in his autobiography. And that intrigued me, so then I had to research what kind of gambling games were being played in Venice in the early 17th century. And that was a fantastic trip into all kinds of dens of iniquity.
How did you do the research of the book, and particularly in this case, I mean, how did you uncover some of these, what must have been fairly obscure references?
Well, that's part of the fun of it. When you know what the story needs, then you know what you need to know. So I had the excuse to go to Venice for work. You know, how often does that happen? So I found that it was very pleasant to be in that great city with a whole lot of things that I wanted to find out, which was about what was the status of gambling. And it was very interesting. There was one particular family of noblemen who had fallen on hard times, so the Doge had allowed them and them alone to run official sort of gambling games. And during Carnival, this was very popular because you would go in your mask, of course, and nobody knew who you were.
We're talking about the Sarajevo Haggadah. It's Fact and Fiction with Geraldine Brooks. She's just written a new novel called People of the Book about the Sarajevo Haggadah. meanwhile, there's a couple of other stories that are going on in the book. There's a love interest, which we won't go into. We'll leave to the imagination and the reading of the listener. But there's also another story going on between Hannah and her mother. Why did you make Hannah's mother such a maternally challenged character?
I don't know, really. I think it's fun to imagine lives that are very different to one's own. And my mother's always been my best friend, so I thought, what would it be like if that was not the case? You know, if your mother didn't really admire what you did with your life, and if that was a source of tension between you. And so the relationship kind of grew up out of that curiosity on my part. And I found in the end that Hannah and her mother both were at fault in letting this relationship become so toxic, that Hannah had been unforgiving and intolerant of her mother's commitment to her career. Her mother is a neurosurgeon, which for a woman of that generation in Australia meant facing a lot of prejudice, and she's an ardent feminist, but it also meant that she wasn't really around much for Hannah's childhood, and Hannah resents that, and it turns her into a fairly toxic adolescent, and the relationship sort of goes to hell from there.
Say something about, now you are from Australia, is that correct?
That's right, born and raised, yeah.
And is it a kind of curious thing to have a conservator like this come from Australia?
Well, I was looking for a voice that I could write convincingly. It's very important to me to have a very compelling voice. And my initial thought was that the conservator would be Bosnian, but I just wasn't getting the voice right. And then I decided to make her Australian, and I'm thinking, is this credible? Would such a person be called in all that way? And, you know, and I was a bit troubled about this. And then I wanted to do some research on how a real-life conservator would investigate a wine stain on a piece of old parchment. And so I had an email correspondence with the chief conservation scientist at the Fogg Museum at Harvard. And he very kindly said, you know, bring some wine and we'll splash it on some old parchment scraps that I have here, and I'll show you how we'd look at it. And so I arrived to do that with him, and he greets me at the desk with, g'day, mate. So he was from Australia, so suddenly I felt that my character wasn't too outlandish.
Well, you did some incredible, incredible research. Now, was there really a sheep that went extinct? Because in this book, there is something very important part of the plot is that there was a sheep that went extinct 300 years ago.
Yes, well, I'm not sure when exactly the sheep went extinct, but the real conservator told me that she could tell from looking at the parchment that it came from an extinct breed of Spanish mountain sheep, and that that would help date the creation of the book, because obviously you can't be making parchment out of sheep once they've gone extinct. So that was based on fact.
So were there any challenges that you encountered in making the transition from reality to fiction in this book?
I found it more challenging to write about incidents that are still in living memory, such as the Siege of Sarajevo and World War II, where people that I was inspired by are still alive. So I felt a certain duty to the real actors, if you like, even though my characters are totally created, I needed to write an afterword that set out the difference between fact and fiction in that case.
And people can also go to that wonderful article in The New Yorker that you did in December of 2006.
For the World War II.
For the World
history,
War
yeah.
aspect of that, that's right. Now, a major theme of this novel is how current enemies, Jews and Arabs, have at times rescued each other in times of need. What lesson do you want your readers to draw from the book?
Oh, I think it would be very presumptuous of me to tell readers what they should draw from the book. I think you have your own relationship with the book, and that relationship will change through time. I found myself that when I reread novels, I often find I get a completely different message from them than I got when I was an adolescent, perhaps reading something. So I wouldn't dare to tell people, but I guess one of the things that's been a kind of guiding light of my own journalism and then my fiction is the real core belief that what unites us as human beings is always greater than what divides us.
Geraldine Brooks. Her latest novel is People of the Book. It's about the history and rescue of the Sarajevo Haggadah. And you can go to our website at writersvoice.net for a link to an online version of the Sarajevo Haggadah and leaf through its pages there. Also, we have a link to Brooks's article in The New Yorker. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. My guest, California poet laureate Al Young, has written the following, quote, "Music, with which poetry remains eternally intimate, seems a dead ringer, as it were, for life. And while each also seems invisible, I always catch myself asking, what is life but spirit? Spirit thought made hearable, seeable, smellable, touchable, and delectable." Young is a celebrated African-American poet who is also a musician, and music has been a touchstone of his life and work. Born into a musical family in a tiny town on Mississippi's Gulf Coast, after college he moved in 1961 to San Francisco to get close to the beat revolution in literature and poetry going on there. He's remained in the Bay Area ever since, inspiring poets, students, and audiences with the supple power of his poetry and the music of his voice. He's just come out with a new book called Something About the Blues, an unlikely collection of poetry. It's out from Sourcebooks Press as part of their Media Fusion series of poetry book and CD sets. Well, Al Young, welcome to Writer's Voice.
It's my pleasure to be here.
Your wonderful new book and CD, Something About the Blues, an unlikely collection of poetry. Why is it unlikely?
Unlikely because I think it's the first time that a thematically based collection has been assembled like this, meaning a sole author who has written so many poems that touch upon the blues and jazz and music in general as a theme in his poetry. There have been collections of poems in which numerous poets have been gathered who write about the same subject, but I think this is the first time that this has happened.
And you actually also have a background as a musician.
That's correct. I still work a lot with musicians, largely these days, rather than playing guitar and singing. I sing with masterful musicians and recite poetry in many of my programs, and it's enormously popular.
Do you sing your poetry, or what is it?
I sing standards largely.
Wow.
There isn't a poem that I've written that doesn't have a parallel in a standard American classic of some kind, and so it's a lot of fun to try to match text to score.
Well, could you give an example? I mean, without singing, there is actually at least one track on your CD in which you are singing, and you have a beautiful voice, but I'm not going to ask you to sing. But give us an example of something that you might do.
For example, there's a poem of mine called Saudade. Saudade is the Portuguese word for, I would translate it as something of the blues or longing. Catherine Vaz, who's a Luso-American poet, once said that the Portuguese are so fond of longing that they find themselves quite often just longing to long. And with that, I'm either going to sing, if I perform it, one of the bossa nova classics, such as Quiet Nights, the Antonio Carlos Jobim song with English lyrics by Gene Lees. Quiet nights of quiet stars, quiet chords from my guitar, floating on the silence that surrounds us, that kind of thing. Or something of that nature. That's the kind of matchup that we'll do.
Oh, that's wonderful. And Saudade is, in fact, one of the poems you do have on your CD, and we'll be playing it a little bit later.
Ah.
Now, you were at one time a guitarist and lead singer for a small jazz folk song ensemble, and you wanted to be a musician, I heard, more than a writer. So what made you decide to be a writer?
No. I don't know where you got the information that I wanted to be a musician more than I wanted to be a writer. That's not true. They were parallel loves. I come from a family that was quite musical. My father was a bass player and tuba player. He played both instruments at a time when, in order to keep gigs, you had to know both of those instruments. And I grew up in a house full of recordings. A brother who was a wonderful pianist, late brother who died recently. Everyone played something at a time when music education and music in American life was quite active. My father stopped playing in nightclubs after two or three of his friends died in ways that he thought were preventable. And he was a man who did not drink or smoke. And so at one point he came to his senses. He said, I'm playing this music in clubs where people do drink and smoke and all these things happen. And he just turned his back on it, not on music, but on performing. I reached a point early in my performing career when I realized that being at home and writing, you had an advantage. You could always mail it in. You didn't have to be there. And this was before the advent of email and fax and this sort of thing. And so I've loved both of those areas. There are parallels between music and writing, and I'm constantly drawing comparisons between the two. For example, text, which is what most people think of as poetry, print on paper, to me is musical score. It's notation that has to be sounded or brought to life in some way by the voice or through some instrumentation. And I know that there are language poets. There are people who work with concrete poetry or visual representations of poetry who would disagree with this. But for me, the human body is the instrument for the reproduction of poetry.
Well, you know, I wonder if we could actually play one of the tracks on your album here. Maybe just even a few bars of it, where you talk about this connection. I think it's your poem, The James Cotton Band at Keystone. Let's listen to that.
Everybody knows this is the blues, right? It runs right through the mainstream of American music. And whether you're listening to an actual blues artist like B.B. King or Lead Belly, or you're listening to George Gershwin or Emmylou Harris or Willie Nelson or Charlie Parker or John Coltrane, Aretha Franklin, you're listening to the blues. I don't know what you can say about a nation whose basic music is the blues, but it sure makes you feel good sometimes. Cotton Band at Keystone. And the blues, I tell you, they blew up on target. blew the roof right off and went whistling skyward, starward, stilling every zooming one of us mojoed in the room that night, that instant, that whenever it was. Torn inside, at first we all got turned out, twisting in a blooming space where afternoon and evening fused like Adam with Eve. The joyful urge to cry mushroomed into a blinding cloudburst of spirit wired for sound, then atomized into one long, thunderous, cooling downpour. What ceased to be was now and now and now. Time, somehow, was what the blues froze tight like an underground pipe before busting it loose in glad explosions, a blast that shattered us. Ice, flow, and all. The drift of what we'd been began to shift, dragging us neither upstream nor down, but lifting us safe and high above the very storm that only flashing moments ago we'd been huddling in for warmth. Melted at last, liquefied, we became losers to the blues and victors both. Now that he'd blown us away with his shout, this reigning brown-skinned wizard, wise to the ways of alchemy, squeezed new life back into our broken hearts, breathing through cracks, coaxing and choking while speaking in tongues that fork and bend like the watery peripheries of time, a crime no more punishable than what the dreaming volcano does, waking from what it was. Believe me, the blues can be volatile too, but the blues don't bruise, they only renew.
What are you laughing about that?
I'm just laughing because it's such a joy to hear poetry.
It is. It's a joy to hear poetry, and it's a joy to hear it in that way, so united with the music. You know, as I was listening in your introduction, that's a kind of poem too, a kind of ritual calling out of the names of the great blues folks in our culture.
Yes. It would take all night to recite all of their names because American music, as the introduction suggests, is just infused with the blues.
And that last line, the blues renew, could you say something more about that?
Yes, the blues are, it's an interesting form. It's always a form that's been riveting to me and evidently to the world because it's thought of as being an expression of sadness or dejection or depression. And actually, it's revitalizing in that once someone interacts with the blues, they develop a little bit of hope in some way. It's almost as if the old adage about misery loves company is energizing in some way. There's a very famous blues line that goes, I may be blue, but I won't be blue always. The sun's going to shine in my back door someday. In other words, these two clashing statements, these contradictory utterances, actually resolve into one because you declare your blues, you declare the situation that you're up against, and yet there's a hopefulness that comes out of this very expression that empowers the utterer to go forth.
Yes, and you also say something, you have a little essay, Al Young, and we're talking with poet Al Young, poet laureate of California, about his recent book that's just come out, Something About the Blues, an Unlikely Collection of Poetry. You have a little essay on poetics at the end of this book, and you say that music is a dead ringer for life. What do you mean by that?
What I really mean by that, I don't know if it comes across in the text, is that one of the definitions of being alive that biologists will give you is unpredictability. If something is alive, and if an organism is alive, it's unpredictable. There's no way that you can chart what it's apt to do, how it's going to behave. You can do it to a certain extent, but every molecule is imbued with a kind of individuality that is ultimately radical. You cannot predict its course. In our own technologically overloaded society, where we seem to be headed towards a world in which you'll have a button that you can push to make anything and everything happen, we're going to have a button marked surprise, or I should say surprise, because once you think you've gotten everything down pat, that you can do everything on cue and everything electronically or mechanically, you invite a kind of tedium or monotony or decay that will ultimately destroy the society. The late, great James Baldwin talked about this once, and I was honored to hear him. And he said that you can understand why society wants us to mind our business, obey the law, go shopping, raise your families, pay the bills, this kind of thing. But if you don't get this radical individual who comes along from time to time, the Martin Luther King, for example, the Bessie Smith, then you are sure to fail as a society, because societies do not grow with adherence to the law. That is, something has to... You have to have people in the society, you have to have organisms that behave in an unpredictable way, that are going to do things that shake things up, particularly in a democratic society or a society that professes to be democratic.
As you're speaking, I think of how the Native Americans would anoint somebody, a man who would go around as a woman or would do things backwards or say things backwards.
Yes, I've read about this.
Perhaps the same kind of role as the poet that you're talking about here, or the musician.
Yes.
At the end, the very last sentence in this book, which I think is a beautiful one, you say, after 60 years of listening, I still feel as though I can't get started.
That's right.
What do you mean?
Well, I actually, that's a reflection, that's my reaction, a delayed reaction to a line that was fed to me by the late Charles Mingus, wonderful composer and bassist. Many of the listeners will be familiar with his work, which is gaining momentum now that he's been gone these many years. I asked him, or Janet Coleman and I, we did a little book on Charles Mingus called Mingus Mingus, which is still in print and people seem to love it. We were teenagers who befriended him, and he was very good to us, almost as though he knew we were going to grow up to be writers and write about him. And we once asked him why he always performs the song, I Can't Get Started. I've been around the world in a plane. I've settled revolutions in Spain. Everybody knows that. And the North Pole I have charted. But I can't get started with you. And we asked Mingus, why do you always play that? He said, because I feel like I just can't get started. That's what he told us. Someone who was as masterful as he was as a musician, as a creative artist, felt that with every new endeavor, he was beginning again. And that's the way I have come to feel. And I think that is the secret to life, really. Each moment gives us an opportunity to make a new beginning. We're always starting over again. There's a reason they call it recombinant DNA. There's nothing new. We just take the old elements and recombine them to come up with something new. But the moment is where it all happens.
Well, that leads into actually two things that I thought about. One thing is you once wrote that poetry keeps teaching me the only time there is now.
That's right.
Yeah.
And that's right.
And the second is, Al Young, you have a poem on this book. The book is Something About the Blues, an unlikely collection of poetry. It's called Distances. And
yes.
And I love that poem, and what you were just talking about that really reminded me of that. Would you like to hear a little bit of that?
Please, and I'll talk a little bit about how it came to be written.
That would be great.
Afterwards.
Okay, let's hear that. And actually, let's listen to the introduction to that, because I think that's what we have time for.
We think of ourselves as disparate bits, little cocoons of flesh that are separate from one another, and this is what's killing the earth. This is one of the messages I got reinforced by watching Al Gore's powerful movie. We are all members, we are each members of one another, and the very concept of the other is what's killing the planet. There is no such thing as the other. Ancient peoples knew this, but in consumerist society, we don't quite get it, because commercials tell us this is our shampoo, these are our clothes, this is our toothpaste, my car, my shoes, and so forth. And we're raping the planet to hold up this falsehood.
I think back now, I was listening to that. There's a poet named Tom Raworth, R-A-W-O-R-T-H. He wrote a book in the 1960s called The Distance Anywhere. And that had a profound influence on me. Not so much his poetry or the book, the title. Because it got me thinking. Just about that concept. That's what's so wonderful about poetry, is that it sort of threads ideas into your consciousness that may not have entered your consciousness any other way. And the title seems to suggest that distances are equal. They may seem to be far and near, but there must be a secret of some kind that allows you to bridge the distance anywhere, and I think that secret is love.
So I wanted to actually ask you a couple of things about your growing up, because you mentioned your father, who was a musician.
Mm-hmm.
You were born in Ocean Springs, Mississippi.
Which no longer exists, really.
Really?
Katrina wiped it out. It's on the Gulf of Mexico. It's on that Gulf Coast, and the Gulf Coast was possibly more hard hit than New Orleans in the wake of Hurricane Katrina. But it's not as sexy in terms of reference, and so it doesn't get as much news coverage as New Orleans does.
So was it a small place?
Ocean Springs, yes, was tiny. It was right next to Biloxi, which is much better known.
But it's a very different kind of place than the one that you ended up in. You ended up in San Francisco. You went there in 1961.
Just That's
in,
right.
Just
I
in time
there.
Right, and just in time for the counterculture.
Yeah. In fact, I think the so-called counterculture actually drew me there. I was one of those kids who was always looking at beyonds. And you'll remember that during the McCarthy era of the 1950s and early 1960s, poetry began to emerge again. I've noticed that poetry has this kind of vitality. It always becomes big in times of crisis and darkness, almost as if we instinctively go back to our original language. Poetry is huge right now, and I think it's because we're inhabiting such a dark, anti-human era. And so you need an unmediated form of expression. Something that's not, doesn't have a sponsor, it doesn't have a corporation backing it. You cannot say in America these days what you really want to say on television or in the major magazines or newspapers or motion pictures, but you can say it in poetry. So I saw that happening back in those days, and the so-called Beat Generation emerged in that atmosphere. And the center for that, according to the Evergreen Review that I read as an undergraduate at the University of Michigan, was San Francisco. There was, I think it was issue number 3 of the Evergreen Review. It was called The San Francisco Renaissance, featuring, you know, writers like Allen Ginsberg and Michael McClure and Leroy Jones and Diane DePrima and Jack Kerouac and Philip Whalen and William Burroughs, and on went the list. And I said, well, San Francisco sounds like the place to be. When I reached the Bay Area, I felt as though I were home again. For one thing, there was water all around me. And that's the way it had been in Ocean Springs, Mississippi.
I want to actually bring in, you talked about Charlie Mingus before.
Yeah.
And you start this book, Something About the Blues, not with a poem of yours, but with a poem by, why am I blanking? Wait, this is not right.
Is the epigraph to the book?
Oh, no. And you start the book with a poem by Langston Hughes.
Yes.
Weary Blues.
Weary Blues.
One of my favorites, and actually it's one of my favorites from a CD that I've had for, must be about 20 years. It's called Weary Blues with Langston Hughes, Charlie Mingus, and Leonard Feather.
Oh, yeah.
Do you know that album?
I do.
And I wondered if I could just play, I've queued up, not the whole thing, but just starting in, we'll just play a little bit of it, and then I'd like to just hear your comments and your reaction to it.
Sure.
Okay, great. Well, Al Young, thanks so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice. The book is Something About the Blues. It's out from Sourcebook Press.
Sourcebooks Media Fusion is the way they build themselves. This particular book, because they have really been revolutionary in including audio CDs in their books in this Media Fusion series, so that people can actually hear what writers sound like.
And that's what's really so wonderful with poetry. I mean, I think we've gotten away from that poetry, especially in the academic sphere.
Oh, my goodness, it's awful. Don't get me going on it.
Oh, well, do you want to say a little bit about it?
Yes. When I teach poetry, as I do from time to time, I draw on the extensive audio library that I have of poets reading their works. And there's hardly an American poet who lived in the 20th century, certainly the 21st century, a major American poet, whose voice I don't have recorded one way or another. And when I bring that in and play it for my students, it changes the entire atmosphere of the class and the course, because they're reunited with that vibration, the vibration of the human voice. We are vibrations. That's why music and poetry affects us so much. We are frequencies. And when you're simply looking at disembodied text on a page, it's very difficult to understand what poetry is all about. But when you actually hear it, the difficulty recedes.
And that goes right back again to the theme, really, of this book and in many ways of our conversation, and that is the connection between poetry, music, and life.
Yes.
California Poet Laureate Al Young. Well, that's it this week for Writer's Voice. Please join us next week for a conversation with author and physician Kevin Patterson. We talk about his novel Consumption. It's about the Canadian Arctic and the Inuit people there. Find out more about Writer's Voice and upcoming authors at our website, writersvoice.net. You can find all kinds of interesting links there. This week, you'll find a link there to the Sarajevo Haggadah, and you can also hear a special web extra of our interview with Al Young. Thanks for listening to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.